This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You always told me it takes time. It has taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress?
I hate you, naturally.
And I hate black people.
Things are going to get worse before they get better.
What is presented to me as an American does not look like me.
Because you're not allowed to be a black man in corporate America.
You give us a hard time for being white, being American, and being in control.
And when you live under a situation like that constantly, and then you ask me, you know, whether I approve of violence, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, there's a lot of crazy stuff happening right now. And you know what? We need a space where we can debrief some of it and deconstruct. If you've been looking for a POC-centered podcast that engages with intersectionality, religion, critical race theory, and some hip-hop culture, then you need to check out Profane Faith. I'll be your host, Daniel White Hodge, and we go in every other week. So check us out wherever you find your podcasts, or check us out at whitehodgepodcasts.com to see what other platforms we're on. Cool? All right. Peace.
All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter Podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter.
What's going on? We have an incredible interview this week, one that we've had in the hopper for a bit, and I'm excited to be putting out there with another Content Warning collaborator, somebody who's with us at Content Warning, which is exciting. But before we get into it, anything we want to chat about in the intro segment of today's episode?
Well, there's been something happening on Twitter, and it connects with a Clubhouse conversation that we had on Tuesday morning and Deconstruction Coffee Hour. Shout out to that. If you aren't on the Clubhouse app, it's pretty easy to figure out. Live Tuesday mornings, 6 a.m. Pacific time, we do a chat. It's, you know, if you live on the East Coast, it's a normal time for you. But
everywhere else, it's early.
Yeah, we were talking about, like, holding on to uncertainty and how do we let go of certainty. And then it kind of mixed with a conversation that was happening on Twitter because a previous, I don't even know how much we want to get into it, but somebody that used to be, I would say, kind of an influencer in progressive spaces, maybe a little bit deconstruction and ex-evangelical spaces, has gone down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole. And there was a lot of dialogue about it because she came out with a tweet that essentially was denying the Holocaust. And so we were so shocked, and people had like had her muted for a while and just kind of not paid attention. And then suddenly, you know, look at her feed and is like, oh man, like this is outrageous. And so it led to a whole discussion about how, like, when it comes to questioning everything, there's people that it's like almost there's a couple things happening there. I don't know. Give your takes because we had this good discussion. And I want to kind of bring it up and talk about your reactions and stuff.
Yeah. And I didn't know who this person was. I had like Not to say that I hadn't seen them in the Twitterverse, but I don't ever remember them being a commonplace name. But I think that's because I was late to Twitter. I didn't really get into Twitter until we became good friends. We started doing this together. And then I was like, what's this Twitter thing about? And I had had one, obviously, since like 2007. But I had not used it aside from, if you go way, way back in my Twitter feed, you can find me tweeting like Andy Stanley quotes or something, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's like me and my Instagram. Way back is Tim Keller quotes.
Yeah, but, you know, I we've talked about this with some other folks on the podcast. I would love to do an episode with a guest about the very particular dynamic of kind of the anti-establishment coming out, beginning to question the narrative, and even kind of like the woo-woo spirituality, right? Like kind of like leaving fundamentalism into this more like open, maybe new age, or, you know, I call it woo-woo spirituality to right-wing pipeline. Mm-hmm. Because it's real. I feel like Tori maybe had touched on it in one of the conversations mm-hmm. that we had. And I'm sure a few other folks have as well. But, I mean, in our Clubhouse chat, Justin Gentry from Go Home Bible You're Drunk had really kind of illustrated well that, like, there's this reality of, like, realizing, oh, this whole narrative that I was handed, this whole structure of reality was not real. And so therefore, what else might be, you know, contrived and not real and a farce? And so that can begin to snowball into a nothing is real. Nothing, no one can be trusted. No one, which then really I feel like is going to just take on the direction of whatever assumptions you are leading with. And to be fair, like, I think that the core or the instigator for these kind of horrifying and somewhat outlandish claims about Holocaust denial began with this pro-Palestinian sentiment that many of us also share, a concern and a care about Palestine and what's happening with the genocide there and what's happening to the people there. And I've talked about this on the podcast in recent weeks. Another shout out to another previous guest, Elad Nohar. I always say his last name incorrectly. Elad Noharai, I believe. I may be incorrect. Scroll back a ways. He was in season one. He was formerly in a fundamentalist Hasidic Jewish sect, came out of that and does a lot of writing from a Jewish perspective about these topics. And he's been talking a lot about how...
I was just going to say that. He has been talking about Palestine and everything yeah. that's been going on.
And how, you know, people are capitalizing on these emotions, these sentiments, specifically right-wing influencers, to perpetuate anti-Semitic agendas, to perpetuate neo-Nazi agendas, to perpetuate Holocaust denier agendas, right? And also, on the other side of it, there's a lot of people using anti-Semitism to as a way to not address Islamophobia and the actual genocide. You know, basically, if you are operating from a framework of knowing your conclusion first and then looking for data afterwards, you're mm-hmm. going to be susceptible to bad information and to conspiracy theories and to people who are playing upon, you know, your emotional response and your kind of knee-jerk reaction. And this is becoming more and more with AI, with deepfakes becoming more prevalent, with voice imitation. You know, I mean, I heard a story the other day of people were doing robocalls before a local election using AI voice manipulation to make a call on behalf of Obama or, you know, various other people being like, hey, I'm calling voters to say this or that, right? We're having to start becoming a lot more skeptical of the information being put in front of us. And that can sometimes lead people to a unchecked skepticism that that leads to these sort of situations. I'm rambling, and it's, I think it's really complicated.
I think, and part of that conversation that we had was, who are the people that are saying which stuff, right? Because when it comes to the Holocaust, you have well-documented historical evidence, and you have physical places, like that even, Marianne William,
I did see that. Yeah. I don't know her name, but I did see what you're, I think, referencing.
I get her last name wrong. People were like, man, is she making more sense than this other Holocaust denier? Because she replied to that tweet and was like, go read a book, visit Auschwitz, like visit, like the, go outside, like watch something.
Touch grass.
There's so much historical evidence. And then the people that are disputing that don't have any credentials for that. And it reminds me of the Flat Earthers. If you've ever watched part of the documentary, there was a piece that where they try to twist the narrative and say, well, the reason that scientists and people with PhDs say that the Earth is round is because they've had so much education, and education is where you get indoctrinated with this, according to them, bullshit, that they've had so much more time to have been indoctrinated. And so it's like these conspiracy theorists find a way out of everything, and I'm not even going to say that's limited to conspiracy theorists, because I had shared in that conversation that there's been some, like, and this is my education nerdiness, intense reading wars happening about the scientific evidence of how children learn to read. And there's people that just love their methods of teaching reading, and they're able to find ways to talk around the research and dispute it and say, like, well, we know better because we're seeing things happening in classrooms that the researchers don't know about. And teachers buy into that, right? And so even if it's not a wild conspiracy theory, there's ways to just justify your side of things. And it just becomes a mess where you're like, where do I even begin to muddle through all of this nonsense? And it's like, well, let's go with what research and evidence shows and what people's credentials show at some point, you know?
It's a failure to look at the evidence, to have an evidence-first or a data-first approach to figuring out what you think about things. And it is coming from a perspective of starting with the conclusion that, I mean, I saw people do this with the vaccine and with COVID. You know, people would be like, oh, we're starting with the conclusion that the pharmaceutical companies are these wealthy, greedy, corrupt institutions, right? And so then I'm going to form my opinion about the vaccine and its efficacy and various other aspects of the vaccine based on the fact that I think the pharmaceutical industry is inherently corrupt. Well, that's not, you can't start with a conclusion about the pharmaceutical industry,
right,
and then come up with a specific conclusion about a very particular vaccine, because you're going to be able to find either data or a lack of data, which sometimes people will use to, you know, influence you or convince you of what you already believe. If we start from the position of the government is corrupt, then I don't have to show you data. I can just go, hey, the government is corrupt, and therefore, you know, XYZ, you know, why wouldn't you be skeptical of these things, what they're telling you, because they are, you're starting with this conclusion that you can't trust the data, rather than going like, hey, let me try to collect data, start with data collection, start with like verifying the legitimacy of that data, the consensus around that data, right? Like, is this a doctor who is you know, maybe not a medical doctor or not an immunologist or is not fitting with the consensus of doctors who are in that field, right? When we talk about, you know, somebody might be like, oh, well, I know this professor who said this one thing, but they were not a historian. They were not a professor of history. Yeah. They were not a professor. You know, it's like you can find somebody who will back up your conclusion, your belief that you already decided you believe. Yeah. Or we can look at the data and also look at consensus in that data. Right, it is not going to be when you look at climate science, right? Like there's these high percentage, you know, depending on who you're looking at, 80, 90 plus percent of scientists in this field agree about human contribution to climate change and that climate change is real and that it is a serious threat, et cetera. That means you can find a couple people who are scientists who may disagree with that, but they are not aligned with the consensus of the majority of these content experts, right? And so I just think that in this day and age, and especially when we're coming out of situations where many of us were lied to about things, many of us grew up thinking that, you know, men had an extra rib or women had an extra rib or men had one less rib and dinosaurs weren't real and the earth was, you know, 4,000 years old. Like, we were told these things, and it's a huge shock to realize those things aren't true. And the response, hopefully, shouldn't be nothing is believable. Let's start believing.
There are some things that are true.
Utter nonsense. There are things that are true. There are things that we can actually collect data on and we can be confident about. It's wild to me that this dynamic does exist, but it's really prevalent.
Yeah, and a couple of things I'll say. One is, I don't know if you were doing this, Cortland. We didn't, like, plan this, but I intentionally didn't name the particular person because I think that she's had some mental health issues and some substance abuse issues, and I think there's been a lot going on, and I'm not saying that that justifies her position, but we're not here saying, like, this is a takedown of this particular person. It's more just a conversation about the broader intentionality that it takes to make sure that the information, and as you're kind of exploring and journeying, the information that you're getting doesn't lead down this kind of path. If you're like, I need to know because I just kind of want to know, like, who I'm following, and if it, you know, shoot us a DM and we'll talk about it in other more less public spaces. But the other thing that I wanted to say is we are in a few weeks releasing an episode with a journalist from NPR and having a conversation. And she writes in her book, The Exvangelicals, a little bit about, like, just kind of the connection between, you know, evangelicalism and the propensity to believe some of this QAnon and that kind of stuff. And I've been fascinated about that kind of thing, and then also kind of the conversation we're having where it happens on the other side. So it'll be interesting to see what she has to say and to share that too.
Yeah, and I think that these conversations that we get to have start to challenge some of our assumptions about, you know, the identity markers being a complete way to track whether somebody saying something is legitimate or somebody who is, you know, I talked about this on a recent episode. You can have white gay men who are super transphobic or super misogynistic or various other aspects of problematic, racist. I was blown away when I was super involved in the cannabis and the psychedelic space, how many of those people were anti-maskers, who were anti-vaxxers, who did not believe in isolating during lockdown, who ended up resulting in a lot of people getting sick and a lot of unnecessary harm caused to people because they were in this mindset. And I would have thought, like, oh, those are my people, the people taking psychedelic mushrooms to, like, you know, like, you would not think that those people would be lockstep with my evangelical parents. But in that one particular issue, they were, right? And that was a great example of, you know, the identity marker there, the values in one area. And we say this all the time with, you know, race issues in this deconstruction space. You can have deconstructed some of your harmful beliefs about Christianity and not begin to think about your whiteness as people coming out of white evangelicalism, to think about these other aspects of yourself and where you come from. So
those conversations have to be intersectional. They have to include decolonization and they have to be rooted in harm reduction. But all that to say, we have a really great guest. We have a really great interview here coming up. Transvangelical, also goes by Alicia. And we got to hang out with her at Content Warning. That was delightful. I heard a lot of feedback about her panels specifically and the things that she said that really sparked curiosity and made people think and got people excited and gave some new perspectives. And I heard feedback about all of them, but a couple of people mentioned her by name. So this interview we did before the event, but it was also just lovely to see her. And I can't wait to hear, to share with you all what she had to say in our discussion.
Let's get into it. All right. Another episode of the Day After Podcast. One of your hosts here, Cortland Coffey, along with Megan. Welcome, Megan, to our show.
Hey, hey. And we have a guest today. We have Alicia, who you may know as Transvangelical on Twitter and other places. Say hi.
Hey.
We'll jump in because we've been wanting to have you for a really long time, and we're finally able to talk, so I'm super pumped. If you want to just give our listeners a little bit of context of who you are and kind of your little bit of backstory before we jump into some of the topics that we want to talk to you about.
Yeah, like you said, most people know me as Transvangelical, primarily on Twitter. I kind of expanded out into other apps, but I don't know. Twitter is just, once you find your spot, it's hard to start again on like Blue Sky or something, even though, yeah. But also on top of that, I write and stuff. I have a Substack, and I also have an OnlyFans where you get both sexual content and theological content because I do Strip Theology Thursdays. Which hasn't been every Thursday recently, just because honestly I have not had the time. But most Thursdays I get about a 8 to 10 minute like little video where I talk about some theological topic while, you know, stripping. Okay, so it's nice. Super fun. My background is basically like most people. I grew up very evangelical, very conservative. I went to Bible college and I went to seminary and I have an MDiv. So, and all of that mostly in extremely conservative fundamentalist schools.
Your background is like most people that also grew up evangelical.
I mean, most people, yeah.
Many of
most
our listeners.
Listening to your podcast is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Talk about when the transition for you happened in terms of growing up in these kind of conservative spaces and then beginning to realize that maybe your direction was going to be in a different way, as well as like what brought you to starting the Transvangelical Twitter account and kind of like what that journey's been like. So like both of those kind of like points of transition, those points of origin for who you are today and the work you're doing now.
Yeah. So one of the big things that made me like really start to walk away from evangelicalism was Under Oath, the hardcore band, or post-hardcore, I guess they're post-hardcore.
Screamo, like, if you're nasty, yeah, you know, yeah. Whatever.
And like, so they broke up for like 10 years. Right. And then they got back together, like 2018, maybe somewhere around there. And they released a music video where they swore. And like the evangelical circles just like lost their mind. And I was at the point of like, I don't care. I don't care if somebody swears. That's not a big deal. I mean, I should probably qualify. Like, I was still very conservative at this point. I was going to like a vineyard where I felt like I was liberal. You know how people at vineyards feel like they're liberal, but really they're not. They just, you know, drink coffee. Yeah.
Yes, I know exactly. Yeah. Like, I can identify exactly what you're saying with such little specificity, but I feel
exactly.
It.
Yeah. But yeah, like under oath swore in a song, and people were like losing their minds, and like I actually like lost touch with Under Oath, even though like they were one of my favorite bands, and especially while they're broken up, I didn't really care. But I didn't know all like this backstory where Spencer was supposedly on drugs and like people were like trying to cancel them back then. This whole like backstory. And then after they broke up, he ended up having a drug problem, but he didn't necessarily whenever like he was being accused of it. Anyways, basically like looking at his life and like evangelicalism basically just cast him out because he had an issue with drugs, and it didn't sit right with me. Like, no wonder why this guy doesn't want to be Christian anymore. Do you see how you're treating him? Like, this is an actual person. We need to stop like platforming people and trying to make them into some perfect like Jesus character behind a microphone. Like, he's a real person. He has real struggles. Like, let's get over this. In evangelicalism, but just no. It, like, because he swore, like, it was done. And so that really kind of showed some cracks in it. And this is like all while Trump was, you know, president. And I wish I could say that watching Trump be president was like that breaking point for me. It really wasn't. That came later. It took me most of the Trump presidency to actually realize that like how bad this actually was. I realize that it's like it's 2024 now, and so it's been a few more years, but I still feel like I'm like new to the more progressive circles. Just because, like, I don't know, it seems like the Trump presidency really wasn't that long ago, even though it's been almost 4 years, which is weird.
Yeah.
I think it's because we're still living in the shadow of the Trump presidency, and then we have the foreboding doom of perhaps, like, whether we'll have to go through that again. Mm-hmm. It's this, yeah. I'm curious, and you've talked about the, you know, what the response was to just swearing. I see you handling all kinds of dialogue and discussions with Christians, with conservative Christians that are super hateful on Twitter. And the funny thing is, I feel like they'll try to get you into like a theological tailspin, and you end up owning them because you often know more about theology than the people that are trying to like, hey, what about this? Checkmate. And you're like, actually, no. Like, but and so I'm curious, like, how has that kind of, as you started Transvangelical and as you've started engaging in those discussions, is it just, do you have like a strategy that you use? Is there like a certain type of conversation that you will engage in and then some that you absolutely won't? Or how has that process been for you as you've been engaging with some of the ridiculous things that have been happening since, I feel like, people have far more than just swearing that they're trying to attack now.
When it comes to like dealing with things, I have rules actually that I set for myself. And I actually just set one for myself earlier today, just because I realized that I was actually not living up to what I actually feel like I should stand for. And I'll share that in a moment. But I'm no longer quote tweeting to own somebody. I'll quote tweet somebody that I like and like boost their post or something, but I'm not going to quote tweet to own anybody. I don't go into individual people's comments and to try to own them. If it's a person, like a political person or somebody like who's, it's a platform, not a person, like I'll do that. To me, that feels different. But yeah, whenever it comes to my posts, I don't post anything that I don't know what evangelicals are going to say to it. Like, I was evangelical enough. I was on that side. I was the one saying that stuff just as long as they have. Like, I know what they're going to say. And so nothing really surprises me. And I, like, to me, I find it funny whenever they start to say awful and hateful things, because like, you know that you beat them theologically at that point. And so I just lost my train of thought. Anyways, so like I don't get into any arguments that I don't know where it's going. But also use a lot of satire. Like, and I know, like, I set people up to like show the fact that they're inconsistent or just the fact that they don't know the history of theology. Like, most people don't actually know the fact that original sin and the fall isn't like a Christian belief per se. It was created by Augustine, which was like over 300 years later. It, like, in reference to that, Jesus was further away from, or Augustine was further away from Jesus than Bernie Sanders is from the founding of the United States. Like, think about the founding fathers and what we think of with Bernie Sanders, and like how we went from the start of the United States to him. Yeah, there's been more time between Jesus and Augustine. Augustine wasn't even doing biblical theology. He was doing allegorical, and he was expanding on biblical theology. That's why he comes up with the stuff that actually isn't backed up by the Bible, because he had concepts that he believed were true because he was kind of this like Roman from Africa. And so he was dealing with his culture, and he was dealing with his own struggles because he believed he was awful because of his sexuality. And so he made up theology that we just assume is correct. Unlike most people, like, so I mean, I have friends that are like, why are you still Christian? And I'm just like, I'm pretty sure it's just the autism and the fact that theology and biblical studies is like that thing that I focus on. I can't focus, like, I absolutely have to study the Bible. And it's awful because it puts me in the same category with some really awful people. But at the same time, like, I really enjoy it. Like, I really enjoy thinking through theology and reading the Bible and reading Greek and Hebrew. I'm not good at Aramaic, so that's just something I got to deal with for those couple sections of the Bible that are written in Aramaic. But yeah, I know that the average person doesn't know more than me. I know that the average pastor doesn't know more than me, simply because I know my obsession with biblical studies is actually like probably close to the unhealthy side.
Yeah.
It feels kind of narcissistic to frame it that way. It's just,
well, I think one thing that's interesting, and I'd love to hear you kind of like pivot and chat a little bit more about, is like, for somebody who had been through so much study and continues to study even after changing your mind about like how you perceive like theology in the Bible and Christianity, like, do you feel like those things have gone in phases? And what was that like? Was there a point where you were like, oh, I'm beginning to see like myself and you know, the way in which I am looking at the world and gender and sexuality as changing, versus like the way your relationship with theology and the Bible was changing? And did those things correlate? And I'd be curious to hear like what your experience was in terms of like kind of like going from the way that the institutions that you kind of were raised up in were processing and thinking about these things to, you know, the areas that you are still continuing to like talk about and work within these ideas in a very different way.
Yeah. I've said this before, probably on Go Home Bible, but I don't really see, like what I went through as necessarily deconstruction. I don't think deconstruction is a good term for me. Like I just felt like I was learning. Like I assumed that, you know, I assumed what I learned in Sunday school and at youth group, was like what people knew. And then, you know, I went to Bible college, I learned more. And then I went to seminary and I learned more. And I just kept learning. And the more that I started learning, like the more perspectives that I got. And so it wasn't like, to me, it didn't feel like, you know, I'm walking away from anything. To me, it felt a lot more like, oh, I'm just growing in this area. And so it still never really felt like I've walked away from anything. I mean, really, I know that my belief in like God and stuff is not, it's not as sure as what it was before. Like my studying has led me to like know that I have no way of knowing if there is a God, right? But it, like every step was slow and through studying. And so to me, it didn't feel like I was walking away. Like if one of you put like Christian language to it, like it felt like I was pursuing God. Like that's what it felt like the entire time. Part of that was like, I gave myself permission to be like, if one thing about the Bible that, we're supposed to be taught, and I know that evangelicals have walked this back quite a bit over the last couple of years, is that God supposedly loves us, right?
And I love how you're like, it's slow to get there, but apparently he loves people. You wouldn't know it by watching the commercials about the Christianity, but
yeah, and you know, I just thought, you know, if God does actually love us, then my pursuit of trying to understand God more, wherever it takes me, if that's an honest pursuit and it takes me away from the beliefs that I was given, is God actually going to condemn me to hell for that? For like wholeheartedly pursuing? And I was like, no. And that's what kind of gave me permission to like become affirming. To accept trans people. And all this was before I actually realized I was trans myself. Like I didn't even gotten to the place where I even had language to describe like my experience as a trans person. So like I haven't even gotten to the part of self-reflection yet, but I worked to that part kind of on my own. So it never felt like walking away. It was always, it always felt like a pursuit of something.
Yeah. I really think that framing is important. And like, I really enjoy the way that you frame the pursuit and the kind of like the melting away of the structures as maybe unnecessary pieces of the framework. And a clarity. How have you seen? I'm very curious of like the people, like you talk about doing OnlyFans, you talk about doing, you know, strip theology. Like, how is it to work and to like, I guess, be in circles where people are interested in hearing about theology and also in this part of, you know, culture? I'm using air quotes, that like is, I was always told, is like worldly, right? And you're talking about OnlyFans and stripping and sex work. And like, it's, for me, it makes total sense because I love sex and sexuality, and I also happen to love theology, but I kind of think myself as like a pretty niche person, but it feels like you've connected with a lot of people who live in that space.
It has been interesting. When I started combining my OnlyFans stuff and theology, I really wasn't sure how it was going to go. I mean, I was still kind of trying to find my niche. And so that was like, I'm going to try this. And it ended up kind of being successful. I got some new fans like right away. But I think one of the biggest things for me is like, we were taught so much we were taught to be broken people. We were taught that our sexuality is this thing for the bedroom. It's for your spouse only, that it doesn't even belong to you. Your sexuality doesn't belong to you. Women are told this more than men, but depending on your purity culture circle, men might've been taught, that their sexuality belongs to their wife or future wife, actually. Cause even if you're not married, you're expecting to get married and you're saving yourself for them, right? So there's this entire part of who you are as a human being that you're supposed to just shut off and not connect it to anything else. That's completely ridiculous. Like, you are creating broken people. So to me, like, integrating sexuality with something that I'm interested in, which is theology, like, that just seems to me, that seems like a natural, like, healing thing to just be like, yeah, this is me. I am a sexual being. I have a sexuality. I also enjoy theology. Like, there's no reason why these have to be separate. Like, these are parts of what make me me. And so it's just really just putting it out there and be like, hey, pay me some money while I do these things that I enjoy doing. I mean, that's really what it was. And I've been able to encounter people that I like. It's healing for people to have, to have a adult content space that is theological, because there's just so much harm. Theology has caused so much harm to a lot of people's sexuality. And I think there's been a lot of healing in some of the stuff that I've done, just because I'm willing to be like, hey, I do theology and I get naked on the internet. And that's fine. And I think that's freeing to actually accept the fact that, all of this can exist in the same space, because it should.
Yeah,
absolutely. I love that. And I feel like there's a set of rules that we were given for sex, like you're saying, and why, who gave us those rules and where did they come from? But I guess I also am curious, because, you know, I think that as we move into progressive spaces, there are people that have a limitation on, like, I guess I'm wondering, have you gotten pushback from even in progressive spaces? And I'm asking this from the perspective of, like, I know this will air after our content warning event, but one of the reasons for that event is because I feel like there's a limitation to some of the expansive conversations we can have about sexuality and sex on this side of deconstruction or evolving faith or, you know, kind of shifting mindsets. And are there people that are like, I don't know, just have you experienced any kind of questions or pushback from folks that you otherwise would expect? Like, hey, I thought we kind of lined up and had similar values, but now.
But now Alicia's taking it too far.
I think because I started OnlyFans so early in creating transvangelical that I didn't really encounter too much of that. But I do encounter a lot of people that are like, where they're unsure of how they feel on adult content. Really, they don't know how they feel about porn. It's really what it is. And it's not that they are against what I'm doing. It's more that, like, they aren't necessarily there or it's not necessarily for them. And to me, like, honestly, I don't care. Like, I mean, not in like a dismissive way, but like, healing from the type of sexuality we were given is such a personal process. It's something that everybody has to figure out on their own, that if you're not there, that's cool. That's cool with me. If that's never going to be your thing, whatever, like, I don't care whether or not you are going and supporting my content. I mean, that'd be nice. Everyone listening to this podcast, go subscribe to my OnlyFans. Like, I don't necessarily care if that is what you're doing, but I do care if you are making it out of a restrictive environment and a restrictive culture that has taught you to hide your sexuality. I don't, if porn isn't your thing, awesome. That's awesome for you. If porn is your thing, that's awesome for you. Yeah. Do it ethically. Like, you know, pay your creators. Know where, if you can't trace back where your content's coming from, just assume that's probably unethical. So, there's, whenever it comes to this type of work, like, part of it is moving that needle as much as you can for whoever, because sexuality has been something that has been used to control so many people that it really needs to be undermined. Taking control of your sexuality is an inherent act of subversion. It's an inherent act of subversion within our culture that uses sexuality to control people. The moment you're able to take that back for yourself, is the moment that you are able to say that those people no longer control me. And I think that's great. However that looks like for you is great for you.
I think that there is one thing that I feel like becomes a common, I guess, point in conversations around expanding understandings of sexuality, and, you know, really gender has become a big part of that conversation too, is where you get this idea of autonomy. And like, I think the way that I grew up, the narratives of conservative evangelicalism, like, really liked to minimize or erase autonomy entirely. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, oh, well, this is the way things are. This is the way boys are. And this is the way girls are. And this is the way sexuality works and the way marriage looks and whatever. It's just like these fixed systems. And I think we kind of sometimes bring that into, at least the way I grew up, queer apologetics as well. Like, we're like, oh, well, it's fixed. You know, you have this like born this way narrative, which I'm not trying to negate that, but I am trying to say that oftentimes we like to compartmentalize queer apologetics in a way that just like kind of fits into that same lack of autonomy narrative. And then as you get into conversations about, you know, things like polyamory, gender fluidity, non-binary identities, bisexuality, it then all breaks down, because, you know, I'll have people sometimes come up to me and they're like, oh, well, like, you know, I'm not judging the polyamorous thing. Like, it's okay for you. And I've talked about it. It's just not for me. And it's like, would you say that to a gay person? Would you be like, hey, yeah, I thought about being gay. And then I like, you know, like, no, you wouldn't, because like you have somehow compartmentalized that aspect of their sexuality as something that they can't control or they didn't choose or they don't have autonomy over. And yet we have more judgment in terms of the way people express their sexuality in these ways that we deem more of like a lifestyle choice. Am I making sense? And do you feel like there is like any aspect of that that you have more thoughts on? Because I'd be curious to hear your perspective from the work you're doing.
I mean, this is going to expand a little bit outside of my work specifically, but we have a okay. This is going to be a long rant.
So I'm ready for it. I just had a long
I'm hoping
rant,
to make it from the beginning to the point I want to make at the end, which is a very long line. Okay. So since the Enlightenment, so we're going all the way back to there.
Yes.
European culture decided that they had reached the peak of civilization, that they understood God, they understood humanity, they understood how to become a civilized society, and was able to then view all other cultures as uncivilized if they were outside of the European mentality at all. Part of this meant that they believed that they came to the epitome of human sexuality and gender. And this is why it's very European to be homophobic and transphobic. Like, they, as a culture, Europeans were like, no, we're like, this is not a civilized thing. Then Europeans just like decided to colonize, and they came in contact with other cultures that had different understandings of sexuality and gender and marriage. And instead of being like, oh, wow, this is really blowing my mind, they pulled a white supremacy and were like, genocide and slavery and apartheid, like, and forced their white understanding of gender and sexuality and marriage onto basically everyone that they colonized. Now, like, jump forward to where we're at today, where we still have this Eurocentric European mentality, where we still have this understanding that civilization is based on heteronormativity. And we're born into that. Like, this is the thing where, like, people get upset about, like, queer people supposedly grooming children. Like, no. Did you grow up in the 80s and 90s? Like, queer people were still the butt of the jokes. Like, you would get beat up if you were queer. Like, it was literally sometimes physically ingrained into you that if you're outside of the heteronormative, that you were wrong. Like, you were different. You deserved to be bullied on the playground. Like, it is ingrained in us to think of everything inside these categories. That is hard to break out of. And so whenever we start to realize our queerness, or realize that, say, monogamous marriage might not be for us, because it's not, like, monogamous marriage is actually not a very popular thing throughout human history. We got there through a few different means, but mostly because of the marriage between Christianity and Roman society. and it just completely ignores the fact that not everyone is built to be monogamous. Not everyone is built to be heterosexual. Not everyone is built to be cisgender. And to break out of that understanding of, like, if you're in this category, then you are, like, if you're assigned female at birth, then you're going to be a girl. Like, having those categories is something really hard to break out of. So we do end up having an issue, especially, like, speaking specifically to the trans community. I've been out. I transitioned in 2020, so I've been transitioning for 4 years. There is a difference between someone who just came out and just started transitioning than somebody who's been transitioning for 3+ years. And, like, we all go through our phases. We'll go through a phase where, like, where we don't like drag queens because we feel like that's somehow encroaching on, like, trans women spaces. And it's really just because part of that, we're breaking out of those categories that we were told to put every single thing into. And it's a process. It's such a big process, because you're talking about dismantling the culture and society that you were given. You're dismantling literally the language that you're giving, because English is a Christian language. Like, it might not have started that way, like, before Old English, but English has become an a Christian language. We are literally given Christian ideas in the way that we think. And so breaking out of all these things, it is a long process. And the more that we're able to deal with it and work through it and recognize that, hey, humanity is fucking creative. Like, every single person is completely different. But like I said, Enlightenment European understanding was people are not different. People are the same. And if you do everything the same, you will have a functioning society. That doesn't actually work. But taking this further, now we have the issue of especially trans people being the target for political legislation, where unfortunately we end up having to play by these very strict categories and the rules that uphold them. And so we have to go and say, yeah, children are trans. And yes, that is true. Children are trans. But at the same time, if somebody is a fucking adult and is like, you know what, I don't want to be a man anymore, I want to transition, they don't have dysphoria, they don't have whatever, like, who fucking cares? It's a person. Like, let them do it. It's not wrong. There is absolutely nothing wrong with transitioning. If somebody wants to be, has always been heterosexual, and they're like, you know what, I don't think I was born gay, but you know, maybe I could enjoy this. Good on them. Like, the problem is like, because queerness is so much out of the heteronormative, and because it's so much in the public eye, it feels like we have to pretend like we fit into heteronormativity in a lot of ways, just so, you know, we don't get genocided. Well, is really what we're at. And so it's so frustrating because we have to play by the oppressor's rules is what it comes down to.
Yeah. And it forces people into those categories, those binaries. You know, I mean, I think about bisexual folks. I've watched a couple men go through being socialized from a very early age as a gay man to I think I might be bisexual, and the culture of monosexuality that's like, no, you have to be gay or straight. You have to, you know, because we trade off this aspect of once I identify as gay, I can the straight guys may not accept me, but I get accepted in this one category, and I'm safe to hang out with their girlfriends, and I'm, you know, but the second I'm bisexual, now it's like, oh, now I'm not safe to hang out with the girls. I'm not trusted like I would be the gay friend because now I'm bisexual and I'm a threat. But I'm also not accepted by straight men because I'm bisexual and I'm gay. So we force people to fit into these, you know, binary categories many times because of safety, because of you know, well, this is where I'm going to be able to find safety in a system that is kind of rigged up in a way that really hasn't made space for the complexity of queerness.
Yeah. And a lot of ways studies have shown people are fluid, all the time. There may be people that are on one extreme or the other on a given topic. Like, there might actually be people that are just fully straight.
There Most may actually, aren't. You heard it here. There may be straight people. That's the best.
We're here for your straight people. Coming out stories of the straight people.
That's there might be straight people. The jury's still out. That's going to be the title of this episode. No, go ahead.
That's great. But seriously, part of the problem is because of social understandings and the culture that we live in, people that are a little bit bi probably aren't going to explore that part of themselves because it's not safe. America is still not a safe place to, you know, see if maybe you could be into guys or girls, like, or non-binary people, like, states still have gay panic laws where gay people and trans people can be killed because somebody claims that they were freaked out because they were gay or trans. Like, those laws still exist. And chances are we could actually get more. I'm hoping not. Like, but things are literally getting worse, especially for trans people right now. That's just the reality of where we live in. Going back to what I was saying about fluidity, like, because of hindrances, people are scared to explore what they might be into now. And you know what? Maybe you're into men right now, but then like three months from now, maybe you're not anymore. Like, my interest in men like changes all the time. to where like, why would anybody let a man touch them? To like, you know, I could really get railed right now, and that would be awesome.
That's the spectrum. Like, I'm right there somewhere in the middle spectrum, of that, right? Too. Yeah.
but like, the thing is people are fluid, and in like life events, things going on, your different relationships, like how you present yourself, it is constantly changing. And the fact that we give ourselves categories, is limiting, which makes me have like kind of like a love-hate relationship with all of the like LGBTQ+IA, like keeping adding things. Like, yes, we need to recognize that different people exist, but at the same time, like, if you're asexual but end up becoming more fluid, and like maybe you become more gray sexual later, like, we gotta have space to let people move in and out of these labels, because people do change. I would have said, yeah, what, 4 years ago, that I would never be interested in I would never be interested in a man. Like, part of that was because I would not have given myself permission to even go there because of my conservative upbringing. But because I changed, like, my sexuality changed. because I allowed myself to recognize I was trans, like, that has allowed me to kind of move back and forth between like the type of femininity that I want to display. Like, people do not just sit in their labels. People are constantly changing. And that, to me, like, it's a beautiful aspect of humanity. It's so, like, humanity is so creative that it's ridiculous that we have a religion that puts people in such tiny, tiny boxes. But to me, like, just accepting, like, trying to break down those barriers of like thinking of people in different labels, is freeing for you, and it's freeing for other people because they know that they're able to just be themselves.
Yeah. And that sexuality in general, like, kind of going back to the very first part of what you were saying about like redeeming kind of just like sexuality in general, was definitely the way I grew up, kind of framed as this bad thing, this problem to be solved, right? Your sexuality was an issue, and the solution was getting married at 18, you know, whatever. But it was like, it was framed as like a problem to be solved or something to be, you know, addressed rather than something to explore and embrace. Megan, go ahead.
Well, and I know, like, you'd mentioned the political landscape and the legislation, and I think because something shifted where we went from like, okay, there's things I never talk about, and that's religion and politics, like in like the workplace or in bars or in public or even at Thanksgiving and with family. And that shifted, I think, with Trump, because I feel like he kind of, you know, was so outspoken about, I want people to be able to have permission to hate people. And actually, I want, you know, and like, then I think Christians got on that bandwagon of like, and I was curious because I just came across, there was some conversation on Twitter, and you might have seen it, about a tweet that says, but if I teach my kids to uphold God's law and righteousness, then by today's moral standards, they won't be considered lovely people. They'll be called misogynist and transphobic and homophobic and unloving and bigoted and even racist. And so there's this like thing that Christians have created to say like, oh, we're being, you know, it's that persecution complex of like, we're not allowed to just, you know, believe that God, like be a Christian without being accused of being hateful. And there's so much that goes into that. And I that needs to be unpacked, but I'm curious just at the kind of the overall level of having seen this transformation as you're also transitioning, like what are your thoughts about how this has happened? Cause I've had people say to me, I feel like you're just a little too political and in like personal relationships. And I'm like, this isn't about politics. This is about humanity. And this is about humans. And I'm curious, like how you approach that and what your perspective is of all of that shift.
Yeah. That's such a complex question there, because there's so many different factors. I do want to say that the thing that Trump did, like almost masterfully, was, I mean, he played racism and white supremacy on racist and white supremacist people. Because white supremacy has actually ingrained in our culture that if we see a fraction of people that aren't white, like less than 50, I think that it's like 17%, or I think that's women. Like if you see 17% of a crowd is women, then your mind registers it as 50%. And that's true across the board with minorities. and so we had Obama, who was who's a black president, right? And so white people had to see a black president for 8 years. And coming from those conservative circles, like the racism was growing. Like it was always there. They just didn't say it out loud. Like they were starting to say it out loud. Trump came on the scene. It was like basically gave people permission to say it out loud. And in some way, like it is like a positive thing to say how you feel out loud. Like that helps you get it out. That is actually therapeutic. That can also be manipulated into causing a lot of terrible things. So what Trump was able to do was take the dominant culture, the culture that has had power 99.9% of the time, and made them feel like they had been marginalized for the past 8 years. Hmm. White people are not marginalized in the United States. Like hands down, like that is not a thing. But Trump was able to make them feel like they were the marginalized people. And with that, gave permission to say all of these things, because then they were able to feel like they were the victims, right? And people, apparently there's this sense of security that if you're a victim, that you can just say whatever you want. Which probably means that you aren't a real victim, because most victims are actually like face other issues. That's neither here nor there. But Trump was able to instill that victim mentality within the white culture. Then we and like I said before, like white supremacy and heteronormativity, like those two things are married together in Western culture. Like we forced heteronormativity on other cultures. So that plays into everything that Trump, everything that Trump was about, because Obama, under Obama, same-sex marriage became a thing. Transgender people serving in the military became a thing. So now heterosexual people feel like, well, not all, obviously, but these especially religious white heterosexual people feel like they are marginalized even further because their beliefs are being stepped on, right? Like, this is the narrative that Trump spun. It's hard to look at Trump and think that he is smart and stuff, but he actually did this like really well. So I don't know if it was an accident or what, or like, it's hard for me to believe that he actually thought it out and did it on purpose, but it still happened.
Yeah.
Move forward to where we are today. We are post Obama. We are post Trump. But we still have Trump era judges. And the fact of the matter is conservative politics have always been about, well, the thing that has unified them has been controlling other people's bodies. And that's just essentially historical. It was segregation, right? Segregation ended. And the moral majority decided that, hey, we have to find something else because segregation isn't going to be the political thing to unite us. Became abortion. The Southern Baptist Convention, they were pro-abortion up until the moral majority. Like, abortion was not seen as a Christian versus non-Christian thing up until... I don't know when was that? Was it 70s or 80s? So that became the thing that the unifying thing for conservative politicians. And in like, even my parents would be like, I will vote for whoever is opposed to abortion, right? Even though most of the presidents have not had any say over like abortion laws because it's the states that actually make those laws, and because for the longest time Roe v. Wade was still in place, like the president had no say in it, but control over abortion and control over women's bodies was a unifying factor. Before that they wanted control over black bodies, over bodies of color. Can you say it? I don't know. Then now we hit 2020 and Roe v. Wade is overturned, right? And there has to be something to be fought in the legislative system that controls bodies. And because of where we're at within tearing down heteronormativity, like we are actually tearing down the American family system, and that's okay. Like, the American family system was built on the subjugation of women, right? Like, it was built on heterosexual relationships. It was built on women not being able to get a no-fault divorce. Like, that is American marriage, American family values. Let's tear that down. Like, and it's working. Yeah. Like, those values are going away, and that's actually a good thing. But some people see that as a threat to themselves. So because conservative politicians need somebody to try to control, and because a group that is a minority is an easy target, and because there was growing acceptance leading up to 2020, it became the new target. And the truth of the matter is there is not enough trans people to like stand up to these laws that are being passed. So it honestly relies on cis people to step up and be allies. But at the same time, do you know how difficult it is to go down to your Capitol and like speak to the politicians? It's actually kind of hard because they will bring up or proposed bills at random times and give you like 12 hours notice that they're going to be voting on it the next day. Like, things like this have happened. Or goes to a vote in the state Senate the same day it leaves the state house. And most people aren't able to just take off work and be like, hey, I oppose this. You're my senator. Listen to me. Like, it's crafted in such a way to where politicians are able to hide the fact that people are against these laws. And statistically speaking, most people are against laws on transgender care. That's not true in every state. There's places like Idaho or, I don't know, North Dakota, where there might be a majority that support trans healthcare bans, but it's not actually popular, but it is something to unify the political landscape. And so that's where we're at is trans people are the scapegoat for politicians. So they sound like they're a unified platform that is trying to save America.
Yeah. And even where it is quote unquote popular, I mean, I would say that it is that way because of gross levels of propaganda and misinformation and,
what about the children?
Campaigns.
I feel like, yeah.
Yeah, it's panic campaigns. I mean, and we've talked about this on the show ad nauseum, but my parents were homophobic and conservative and Christian and very white and subtly racist my whole life, but not vocal, not extremists. I remember, I've told the story on the podcast many times. I would go over to my grandparents' house and try on my mom's old dresses that she had from when she was a kid, and we would put on makeup, and I got a pink Easy Bake Oven when I was a kid, and no one freaked out. Everyone was okay. And now my mom sees somebody, my son, wearing a hair clip, and she's like, oh my God, that's, we got to be careful, and what's going to happen? And it's panic. And I'm like, Mom, what the fuck? What the fuck? Why? Who told you to be scared? Somebody has people have crafted these propaganda campaigns. And so even where there is, you said, maybe public support for these types of bans, it's not people that actually know anything about any of these topics. They're people who've just been sold a bill of scary goods.
And it's ironic because it tends to be in places where, generally speaking, people want smaller government. But people who want smaller government apparently want big government for other people. It's really what it comes down to.
I mean, it's the whole my body, my choice that the anti-vaxxers were grabbing onto. And you're
exactly.
I have so many questions about
it. And also your body, my choice. My body, my choice, and your body, my choice. Basically just my choice.
Well, we're kind of getting up to time, but I feel like we could talk for another hour. You mentioned some places that people can find your work. Is there anything else that, I think you said Substack and OnlyFans and Twitter, any other places that people can find you, and check out the work that you do?
I've gone in and claimed transvangelical on almost every platform. But that doesn't mean I'm there. Twitter, Substack, and OnlyFans is where you're really going to find me. So definitely reach out to me there. And honestly, my DMs are open. I do have boundaries. If you're DMing me on Twitter for sex work stuff, I will probably tell you to send a tip before I respond. But if you have theological questions and things like that, I'm always open.
Yeah, nice. Absolutely. We'll put links to everything in the show notes. And thank you so much. I can't wait. Like Megan said, this episode will be out after the event. But as of we're recording this, we're going to get to hang out next week. And I'm really excited for the content warning event.
It's going to be awesome.
It's going to be a blast.
It is. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. And I guess until we see you soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bye. See ya.
All right. another episode, an incredible guest. We have a bunch more incredible guests coming up on the show, and we're really excited that we've been back on a rhythm. We were for a few weeks. We were like, a lot was going on in life, and so we weren't getting part our Tuesday episodes out.
Yeah,
but
my travel schedule was getting in the way, but we changed our recording day, and that helped a little bit. So
we're ahead of schedule now. It feels good. It means that our intros are usually like a week behind whatever the current event is, but we have a lot coming up. So if you are just tuning in or a regular listener, make sure you're following us around on social media so you can keep up with when we're putting out episodes. Like and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. That's super helpful on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And then we're Thereafter Pod on Twitter, Thereafter Podcast on Instagram and Threads. And if you're wanting to get more involved in the community and help support what we're doing through the show, patreon.com/thereafterpod is a great way to do that. I'm Cortland Coffee. I'm the only Cortland Coffee on the internet that I'm aware of. Extremely Googleable, better for better or for worse. You can find me in all the places using my name. Megan, where can people find, connect, and keep up with you?
I am at The Pursuing Life on Twitter, Instagram. Oh, all the places. I haven't opened Blue Sky in a really long time. And I'm sorry. I know you were an avid skeeter there for a while.
I love that app, but it's like I do it. I'm either like several hours a day or I don't open it for weeks. It's like if
That's how I am with Threads.
It's like I'm living on the app or I forget it exists. It's very hard to beat. And that's part of like it not having an algorithm and being more of a real-time feed. Like if you want to get the things out of it, you have to like be on it. And then once you're not on it, you forget about it. So, but I do love Blue Sky. I post pictures of my ass sometimes on there. If you want to see that, that's usually where that goes.
Nice. All right. Well, I guess that's a wrap. Until next time.
Until next time.